This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. In this portion of the program, we're going to get a behind-the-scenes look at the U.S. Supreme Court. Our guest is court watcher Jeffrey Toobin. He's a staff writer at The New Yorker, a senior legal analyst for CNN, and the author of five books, the latest, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. Jeffrey Toobin joins us this afternoon to talk about the court's recent past, its current members, and where their rulings could take us in the near future. Our guest, Jeffrey Toobin, worked at ABC when he was honored with an Emmy Award in 2000. He has served as an assistant U.S. attorney in Brooklyn and served as an associate counsel in the Office of Independent Counsel, Lawrence Walsh. As I mentioned, he is the author of five books, including Too Close to Call, the 36-day battle to decide the 2000 election, and A Vast Conspiracy, the real story of the sex scandal that nearly brought down a president. His latest book is The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. The publisher is Doubleday. Jeffrey Toobin, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Nice to talk with you as well. You know, at the outset of the book, I thought this was really fascinating. You tell us, reading the book, that it wasn't until the 50s and 60s, in the tenure of Earl Warren, that the court began to assert itself, consistently assert itself, as an independent and aggressive guarantor of constitutional rights. A couple of questions here at the outset. Why then did the court begin to assert itself, and how did it assert itself?
Well, I think the simple answer to that question, and I'm sure there's probably a more complicated answer, but the simple answer is that Earl Warren became Chief Justice after he was nominated by Dwight Eisenhower. And it was right after World War II, and the country was really living still under a system of apartheid. I mean, you had really two entire legal, political, financial worlds for black people and for white people. And Earl Warren decided that, you know, with the Cold War on, we simply couldn't put that face forward to the world anymore. And he decided, along with his colleagues, particularly William Brennan and Hugo Black and William Douglas, to drag the country kicking and screaming into a more integrated world. That wasn't a complete success, but it, to say the least, but it was just very different from what had come before, and that's where you had, of course, Brown v. Board of Education, Baker v. Carr, which talked about legislative apportionment, and Cooper v. Aaron. I mean, all these cases where they decided to basically integrate the country.
And what do you think the current mood, the current legal atmosphere is today?
Well, it's very different. I mean, we've had mostly conservative Republican presidents since the 1960s, and 11 of the last 13 Supreme Court justices have been appointed by Republican presidents, and accordingly, it is a much more conservative court, which is, frankly, how the framers designed the Constitution, designed the Supreme Court, is that it is supposed to be independent of politics for the most part. But it also, you know, reflects the popular world or the popular will, and we've had, you know, mostly conservative presidents and mostly conservative Congresses. So it's not a big surprise that the Supreme Court has followed suit. Not entirely, not all the time, not on all issues, but by and large, it's much more conservative than it was in the 60s.
Yeah, you close the book by, one of the things you say at the close is that the days when justices surprise presidents are over.
Very much so. I think that's, I think it's always been more of a myth than a reality about the Supreme Court, that justices, once they get on the court, you know, move to the left or surprise presidents, and that's. But that's certainly not true anymore. The court has been so much a part of politics, and frankly, Republicans have, you know, put so much effort into changing the court that what we've seen with certainly the last five appointments to the court, Clarence Thomas, Ruth Ginsburg, Stephen Breyer, John Roberts, and Samuel Alito, they have been carefully vetted for their views, and they have all been precisely as they have ruled precisely as expected on the court.
Yeah. One of the justices who wasn't so well vetted, Sandra Day O'Connor.
No, I mean, you know, I think Ronald Reagan had a very different agenda than George W. Bush did in his first appointments to the court. Reagan had promised during the 1980 campaign that he would appoint a woman to the court. He only looked at women in 1981 after Potter Stewart resigned. And he found in Sandra O'Connor very much a kindred spirit, a Westerner, a woman who was raised on a ranch, someone who had just been a judge for a few years, was mostly a politician. She'd been majority leader of the Arizona State Senate. And she was vetted not for as much for her views as just for her general political acceptability, which was high. And I think the generally moderate course she took as a justice should not have been much of a surprise to anybody.
Yeah. You say when it came to abortion, the Rehnquist Court was, in fact, the O'Connor Court. What had been her record on abortion when she was a state senator in Arizona, and how did she come to her views on abortion? Maybe here you would talk with us about her being a pragmatist.
Right. I mean, she did not have a very extensive record on abortion, but you know, she had just not dealt with it a great deal as a state senator. But to the extent she had, it was very much a centrist position that abortion should be legal in the early part of pregnancy, but not as a that restrictions should be allowed, like parental consent requirements and whatnot. And I think that is the course she followed on the court. And it's not just on abortion that she controlled the outcome. I mean, it was civil rights. It was issue after issue. She had an enormous influence on the court because she very explicitly wanted to keep the court in the middle politically.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Jeffrey Toobin, his latest book, The Nine, Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. My name's Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions, comments, 333-9455, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, the toll-free number, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk now with a listener who's waiting for us in Champaign. On line one, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I just had a suggestion, I guess, for the second edition of the book. I haven't quite finished it, but on the Clarence Thomas hearings, you didn't point out that in the book by the Washington Post investigative reporters, Strange Justice, they concluded that Thomas was lying and Anita Hill was telling the truth. Now, you mentioned the study and then, I guess, relegated it to a footnote, but the implication is profound in that we now have on the Supreme Court administering the law of the land a perjurer and a sexual harasser. Likewise, in the Roberts nomination chapter you had, you didn't point out that Roberts lied to the Senate about his non-membership in the Federalist Society, and he's a perjurer too. And I think those points need to be brought out.
Well, I think those are two very different points. You know, my book starts after the Anita Hill hearings is over. I decided not to wade into that that story. And Jane Mayer and Jill Abramson's book, Strange Justice, a book I admire a great deal, I think is the leading investigation of the Hill-Thomas conflict, and they do conclude that Thomas was not telling the truth about what went on there. I am, and frankly, that's my inclination as well, based on the evidence I've seen of the story. The But you know, I am not going to settle that at this late date. And you know, you could write a book, and a book was written about that whole controversy, and I decided not to wade into it. I think Roberts is a very different story. First of all, you know, I think a lot of liberals have a somewhat unfair conception of what the Federalist Society is, like it's something out of the Da Vinci Code. The Federalist Society is an open, honorable, decent group of people who up conservative lawyers. And Roberts said that he'd attended conferences, but he was not a member. If he'd been a member, it was no big deal. And I don't think there is any evidence to suggest that he is in fact a perjurer, as you suggest.
Hmm. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Would you say a turning point for the new conservatives was the nomination and confirmation of Clarence Thomas?
Yes, I think it was, especially when you consider whom he replaced. I mean, he replaced Thurgood Marshall, who was one of the great liberals in the history of the court, and thus, the dramatic change from a very liberal justice to a very conservative justice was a big change. You know, he was confirmed right before the Casey abortion decision, where many people assumed that the court was going to overrule Roe v. Wade in 1992. In fact, they didn't, and in one of the most dramatic stories in Supreme Court history, Anthony Kennedy, Sandra O'Connor, and David Souter, all of whom were relatively new to the court, especially Kennedy and Souter, decided that they would save Roe v. Wade, and I think that's a... that is an example of how O'Connor really did not want to see the court getting too far away from public opinion, which remains generally supportive of abortion rights, at least when it comes to early in the pregnancy.
Hmm. Samuel Alito played a role in that Casey case.
No, I mean, this is one of the great things about writing a book is that when you evaluate people over a long term, you know, look at people over a long time, you see the peculiar connections between them. The one part of the Pennsylvania law that was at issue in the Casey decision that really offended Sandra Day O'Connor was the law that said in Pennsylvania, married women who were seeking abortions had to inform their husbands first. And O'Connor thought this was unconstitutional. She thought it was paternalistic, and she wrote a scathing opinion saying that it had to be struck down. The only federal judge who supported that ruling was Samuel Alito, who was then on the Third Circuit Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that really illustrates the difference between the two of them. And I think illustrates why now the court is such a different place between 2007 and 2005. Just a very different a court because Alito is much more conservative than Sandra O'Connor.
Hmm. How rapidly might the conservative agenda, or maybe we should say the new conservative agenda, as the court has been pretty conservative all along, really, I suppose you can make that case. The new conservative agenda, how rapidly might this new agenda be advanced by the court in the near term? And what's at the top of the list?
Well, it all depends on one thing, which is the outcome of the 2008 presidential election. That is the only factor, frankly, that will determine the future of the court, particularly when you consider that the likely departures from the court begin with John Paul Stevens, who's 87 years old, Ruth Ginsburg, who's 74, and David Souter, who's 69 and doesn't particularly care for the job.
Yeah.
If the three of them are replaced by a Republican president, there's going to be a big change in a big hurry because virtually any conservative named by any likely Republican president will, I think, join the conservatives already on the court, the four of them, in overruling Roe v. Wade, in ending any sort of racial preferences, in shifting the balance even more in favor of the executive versus the legislature. And, you know, it all won't happen overnight, but it'll happen sooner rather than later.
Yeah. Given the impact that the court has on life in this country, has this yet become an issue for the campaigns of the candidates for president?
Well, you know, historically, there are two groups of people who really care deeply about the Supreme Court as a voting issue. And one group is people on the firmly on the left, and the other group is firmly on the right. That is, the real partisans care a lot about the Supreme Court. But frankly, those people are going to vote that way anyway. And moderates, the people who decide elections, the outcome of elections, who switch, have never really been persuaded to make the Supreme Court a major voting issue. And I expect the court will be mentioned, as it has been mentioned more or less in passing in the current campaign, but it probably won't be dealt with extensively, because the people who will decide the outcome don't care that much.
Mm. Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hey, hello. I haven't read your book, even though I see it's on the New York Times bestseller list. And
thanks for the plug. Number two on the list.
Number two. So congratulations. I have a problem. I thought this last term, where I guess it was truly the Chief Justice's Roberts term, was a progressive nightmare on issues of racial integration of schools and other issues that are very important. And I didn't know whether or not precedent meant very much to the Chief Justice and his cohorts, even though he promised that he would be what was the word he used when he was testifying? He would be very moderate in terms of dealing with precedents.
He would care a lot about that. This is a great question, because the Chief Justice talked about moving the court slowly, about being having the court be unanimous as much as possible, and that was is not how he's been, especially in the past year. And, you know, I think liberals had a certain arrogance about Roberts, because they said, look, he's obviously so intelligent. He's so personable. He must be a moderate. Not so. He is personable and intelligent and extremely conservative.
Well, absolutely. I hear he's more conservative than the former Chief Justice William Rehnquist.
I don't think there's any doubt that
that's pretty conservative. Well,
conservative.
I don't know if we would have this problem for progressives or liberals like me if, in my estimation, the Supreme Court of the United States, in a highly partisan decision, had not hijacked the 2000 presidential election in Bush v. Gore. I would like to see, have I gone over the top when I consider that decision hard to fathom in terms of a federal question, and secondly, a proper resolution of the claim under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. And I'll hang up and listen.
Well, you know, this caller is obvious. He said he hasn't read my book yet, but he certainly absorbed a lot of the messages already. I spend a great deal of time on Bush v. Gore. I think as we look back, Bush v. Gore only looks more important in American history. I think it is a major, major turning point, not just in the history of the court, but the history of the country. And, of course, one of the enduring debates in Bush v. Gore is, what were the motives of the justices? Were they really simply deciding a case according to the Constitution, or were they simply ratifying the choices that they made in the polling place? How cynical were they, in other words? And I think one of the problems with the majority's opinion was that it seemed to go back on everything conservatives usually believe. As the caller points out, conservatives usually believe in deferring to states' rights. Conservatives usually believe in a narrow conception of the Equal Protection Clause, especially when it comes to the rights of black people and women. But here, the conservative justices overrode the Florida Supreme Court interpreting Florida law, and found that George W. Bush's equal protection rights had been violated. I think that lends itself to a cynical interpretation of their motives, although I can never say for sure what those motives were. But though my book is not terribly polemical, it's not generally thumbs up and thumbs down on these one decision or another. I do think that Bush v. Gore was a low moment in the history of the court.
Yeah. One of the bright spots, you said, or maybe one bright spot, the bright spot, you say, was Justice John Paul Stevens' eloquence. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, John Stevens, the only justice from Illinois on the bench, is a quiet fellow. He's been there now longer than anyone else since 1975, generally keeps to himself, doesn't lobby his colleagues, and he is someone who I think has a very savvy understanding of how the court works. And he wrote a pair of dissenting opinions in the course of Bush v. Gore where he said, look, you simply, the court never should have gotten involved in this case. You should have never, the court never should have ruled the way it did. And it lends itself only to a very cynical interpretation of what judges do.
Let's take another call. A listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Good. I have a question. There's apparently a case before the Supreme Court that will be heard sometime this year or the coming year on state-issued voter IDs. And as I understand it, it's primarily an issue that's been put forth by Republican legislatures in various states. And on the surface, one would think, oh, there's not a great difficulty with having a state-issued ID to vote. One of the problems that occurs with that is what are the requirements to receive the state-issued ID, often birth certificates and other identifying materials that large numbers of, I believe, lower-income voters, usually the Democratic voters and so forth, may not have easy access to. If the Supreme Court, I'm just curious how you think they may rule on that, because if they do rule that a state has the right to require a state-issued ID before one is allowed to vote, that can disenfranchise a large number of, a large number of Democratic voters. And it's just, okay, I'll just hang up and listen.
Well, I think it's a very big case. I think there's another case before the court which I think is similar, and if you bear with me, I'll just talk about it for a second, which is the court is the federal sentencing guidelines deal with crack cocaine and powder cocaine very differently, much harsher penalties for crack than for regular cocaine. Now, it is true. Now, this is the connection between those two cases. In the photo ID case, the law itself says nothing about race. The law simply says you need a photo ID. The crack cocaine law says nothing about race. But in both cases, there is what lawyers call a disparate impact, that the voter ID law will disenfranchise disproportionate numbers of poor and black people. The crack cocaine there are many more prosecutions of black people for crack than for powdered cocaine, disproportionate. And so the court will look at both cases that on their face are neutral. They say nothing about race, but they have very different impacts on black people and white people. I think one example of how this court is more conservative is they will uphold both laws, because they will not be looking underneath the surface. They will basically say, look, it doesn't say anything about race on the law. We're not going to, you know, we're not going to probe any deeper than that. That's why I think, you know, they're going to uphold the law. But I think this is one of the areas that shows what it means to have a Supreme Court that is conservative, and that they'll stay out of it.
Our guest this afternoon here on the program, Jeffrey Toobin, author most recently of The Nine Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court. Let's take another call. A listener in Chicago, line four. Hi.
Thank you. I was a bit late coming to the forum. Did you address the view of Judge Souter regarding the outcome of the election to the point where he contemplated resigning and was even brought to tears, reflecting upon the decision of the court?
Yeah, well, that's the story first told in my book, The Nine. I mean,
I read a review on it. I just wanted to know if you had addressed it on the show yet.
He hasn't yet, but now's a good time.
Now's a good time, absolutely. Well, you know, Justice Souter is such a distinctive character on the court. He's so different from everyone else I have to say I really have, I get a great kick out of him. He is, so much, he is a, he lives a 19th century kind of lifestyle. Doesn't have a computer, doesn't have a cell phone, doesn't even like electric light. He moves his chair around in his office to catch the sunlight over the course of the day. And with that comes a certain, I think, lack of cynicism. I mean, he really does believe that the court is supposed to be outside of politics. And he was shattered by Bush v. Gore. He really did think Bush v. Gore was a dramatic betrayal of what the court is supposed to be about, and he did nearly resign over it.
Why did he decide to remain on the court?
Well, it's a pretty good job, and I think when push comes to shove, all resigning would have accomplished was letting the new president, George W. Bush, pick his replacement.
Yeah.
And I think that is not something that he wanted to do, and I think that's basically what took over in his mind.
Let's take another call. A listener now in Urbana, line 3. Hi.
Good afternoon. Another great interview, Mr. Toobin. Have any of the justices indicated an opinion one way or the other on the concept of the unitary presidency, which was described in some detail last night on Frontline?
Well, I think unitary presidency is part of the larger constellation of issues involving executive power that are so important right now. And I think what's most important to know is that the formative experience for both John Roberts and Samuel Alito was working in the Reagan White House or the Reagan Justice Department, that's where those issues first were widely aired. And Edwin Meese was the Attorney General, and he started pushing for a broader conception of executive power. I think that's one area where Roberts and Alito will be very aggressive in expanding executive power. I think they genuinely believe that. Sort of historically, one of the curiosities of the court is that, there used to be senators on the court, there used to be people who'd worked in the Congress, and now only Stephen Breyer has spent any significant amount of time in the Congress of the current justices. And there's a real, I'd say, hostility to Congress, and I think that's going to be a big issue going forward.
Thank you.
Let's take another call now. A listener on line 1 on a cell phone. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Celeste. What a wonderful serendipity to have one of my favorite commentators from CNN, whom I admire and respect a great deal, on just after a pledge drive when the argument for giving money to support the station here was, you do things that are so terribly important for us and we wouldn't get anywhere else. I think this confirms it in spades.
Well, thanks for that.
What a nice thing to say. Thank you very much.
I hope
everybody should support public radio.
I have a question. I just call to thank you because I admire your work on CNN and find you to be a very reasonable and fair-minded person. And CNN and WILL for me are what make life bearable sometimes.
Well, that's nice of you to say.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thanks for the call. Let's take another call. Listener in Champaign, line 2. Hi.
Hi.
I did want to respond to your point about the Federalist Society being honorable. In fact, all of the lawyers who were involved in drafting the memoranda on the torture scandal giving us torture were members of the Federalist Society. All the lawyers who set up the kangaroo courts down in Guantanamo, which even Mr. Justice Kennedy said in the Hamdan opinion were war crimes, were members of the Federalist Society. All the lawyers who drafted the USA Patriot Act, that is the blueprint for a police state, were members of the Federalist Society. All the lawyers who gutted the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, the so-called Protect America, were members of the Federalist Society. All the lawyers who approved this massive spying on the American people were members of the Federalist Society. And now we have four Supreme Court justices who have been members of the Federalist Society. And that includes Thomas, who is a perjurer and a sexual harasser.
Okay, I get your point. Yeah. I get your point. And you know, the Federalist Society is a group for Republican lawyers. It should not surprise anyone that many of their members have gone on to high-ranking positions in Republican administrations, and many of them have been appointed to the bench by Republican presidents. I think the most revealing thing you can say about the Federalist Society is that Democrats, very much belatedly, but eventually, have started their own counterpart. There's a group called the American Constitution Society. It's flourishing. If Hillary Clinton or some other Democrat is elected president, I expect many of their members will go on to high-ranking positions. So I don't really think the Federalist Society, which works in the open and is not a there's nothing secret about it, is to be blamed or to get credit for the policies you're describing. This is what the Republican Party stands for now. You know, for a strong executive, for you know, aggressive legislative efforts to combat terrorism. Now you can disagree with them, and many people do, but it's not that the Federalist Society did anything. It's what the people who were elected stand for.
I want to move on to another caller now because we've got we're running down on time, and we've got a couple of folks waiting to talk with our guest this afternoon, Jeffrey Toobin. Next, we go to Effingham County, line 4. Hi.
Yeah, I have a couple of questions I'd like to ask you. One is about this, say the Second Amendment. About it's confusing to me. Like in some places you can have a gun, and other places you can't, and it looks to me like we would have the federal jurisdiction over this, where everybody would be on the same page.
Well, you know, this is another great question, because the Supreme Court is taking up the issue of the Second Amendment for the first time in many, many decades, just this year, or they probably will. They haven't accepted review, but I expect they will. And, you know, the Second Amendment is the single least grammatical sentence in the Constitution, where it speaks in, there are two clauses that appear to be somewhat contradictory. The first clause speaks of the need for a well-regulated militia, and the second clause speaks of the right to keep and bear arms. And one of the outstanding questions in the Constitution that has never been resolved is, does the court believe that the Second Amendment grants individuals the right to keep and bear arms? Well, the Federal Court of Appeals in Washington last year, or actually earlier this year, ruled that the gun control ordinance in D.C. violated the Second Amendment. They said that individuals do have a right to keep and bear arms, and this law violated it. The Supreme Court's going to take up that case.
Okay, and the other question I have is this. Do you see any change in the way that we have the appointments now, the system that we're using? And I'll hang up and listen on.
I don't think there's going to be any change. I think, you know, that nominees have learned that they can basically filibuster their way through without taking any stands. You know, one issue that I do think is going to get increasing attention in the future is the issue of term limits and mandatory retirement at the Supreme Court. The framers wrote the Constitution in the 18th century when people were expected to be appointed in their 50s and die in their 60s, because that's when people died, if they were lucky, in the 18th century. Now we have a situation, fortunately, where someone like John Roberts, appointed at age 50, can be expected to serve for 30 years. And I think some people have a problem with that, and we're going to start to see some proposals to limit tenures of Supreme Court justices.
Let's take another call. A listener on line one. Champagne, hi.
Hi. You know, you're...
We're going to move on. I'm sorry. That's the third time out, and I've got other calls. So let's go to Urbana. Line two, hi.
Hello?
Hi there. That's you.
Yes. It seems that your statement of definition of the unitary principle as a strong president is really an understatement. It appears to me to be an argument for monarchy. The Congress would exist, but it would essentially have no power.
Well, I do think that's an overstatement.
I mean,
remember this, you know, since George Bush has been president, the Supreme Court on three separate occasions has told him that his policies at Guantanamo Bay are unacceptable and unconstitutional. And finally, he went to Congress to pass a law, the Military Commissions Act, to establish a system that might be constitutional. Now the Supreme Court is going to take up the case of whether that's constitutional on December 5th. But when it comes to executive power, I think it is safe to say that this Supreme Court, which is hardly a liberal Supreme Court, has operated as a check on President Bush. Now, whether it's an adequate check or will continue to remain such a check, I don't know. But I do think we're a long way from a monarchy.
I didn't say we were at a monarchy. I said the argument for the unitary principle is an argument for monarchy. I didn't say it existed.
I see your point that... Well, actually, I really don't see your point. I just don't think it has anything to do with the monarchy. But it is the unitary...
Well, let's call it dictatorship, then, and not monarchy.
Okay. I think that's hyperbole. But there is no doubt that there are people in the government, certainly led by Dick Cheney, who believe that the president should have more power than he has now and more power than he's probably ever had in history.
How does the administration feel in terms of who might be the next president, though?
Well, that's one of the great unanswered questions, is the Supreme Court has been very deferential to executive power when Republicans are in office, or has sometimes been deferential, and it is a big part of Republican orthodoxy to talk about the unitary executive and expanded powers of the president. Will that be true if Hillary Clinton's the president? Good question. Don't know the answer. We may find out.
Let's take another call. A listener on a cell phone, line three. Good afternoon.
Yeah, hi, Celeste. Thanks for taking my call. Great show. Quick question, because time is short and I'm going to hang off. Wondering if the guest reads anything to the fact that he's seen workload by the Supreme Court. And
I actually didn't catch that.
Yeah, I didn't either.
I'm sorry. The point of the decreasing workload of the Supreme Court.
Oh,
okay.
Cases, wonder if we could read anything into that.
Okay.
Well, it is really a remarkable change in the history of the court. You have in the 1980s, when Warren Burger was Chief Justice, the court was deciding 150 cases a year. Last term, they decided 68, and it's been in the 70s and 80s for years. There's a lot of dispute among Supreme Court geeks, a group in which I count myself, about why this has gone on. The federal courts of appeals are all more conservative, so they disagree with each other less. The justices are older. They don't want to work as hard. I think there are lots of reasons, but John Roberts, during his confirmation hearing, said he thought the court should be taking more cases. But so far it hasn't happened, and my sense is it's not going to happen in a very big way.
Hmm. Here's another kind of inner workings of the court kind of question. What role, how significant a role, have the justices' law clerks played over time in the decisions reached by the court?
Well, yeah, I am something of a skeptic on the power of law clerks. I think they are very excited to be there, and if you ask them about their roles, as I certainly did in the course of reporting my book, they often describe a fairly substantial role, and they do a lot of drafting of opinions. But I think, by and large, the what matters about the work of the court, which is how the justices vote and which direction the law is going on major issues, that's really determined by the justices, and the law clerks are very much passengers on that issue.
Should the court be more transparent?
I certainly think so. I think there is no argument against cameras in the Supreme Court. I think that's it's terrible that there are no cameras there. It's even worse that there's no audio release on a regular basis of Supreme Court arguments. And I think that's one area where, over the next few years, there's likely to be some thawing. Historically, they have, in major cases, released audio fairly promptly. Bush v. Gore, the Michigan affirmative action case. And I think that will become more routine. But I think the workings of the court should be open to the public. And I think, for the most part, people would be impressed because it is a very impressive institution. They're smart people. I think they're trying to do a good job. And if you watch them in action, you're impressed.
So why does the court keep itself and its working so hidden from us?
Like most government officials, the court operates under the rule, the less scrutiny, the better. David Souter famously said, there'll be cameras in the Supreme Court over his dead body. Justice Scalia is very concerned about sound bites being taken out of context. In other circumstances, that's simply a risk people take. Public activity is open to public scrutiny. Supreme Court arguments are supposed to be public, and they should be open. But the court simply has the power not to release it, and they're exercising that power.
Mm. Jeffrey Toobin, thank you very much for talking with us
this afternoon.
Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer at The New Yorker, a senior legal analyst for CNN, and the author of 5 best-selling books. His latest, The 9 Inside the Secret World of the Supreme Court, number 2 on the New York Times bestseller list. The publisher is Doubleday.